Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When you think about something like the state of Vermont's policies around COVID-19 and schools, there are so many threads to pull on. Whether a school has in-person classes or is remote or hybrid can affect teacher and staff exposure to the virus and health safety, which can affect their job security. It can have an impact on how families are able to deal with food insecurity. It impacts the mental health of students and families. The jobs of parents and guardians are, of course, affected, and that can have a gender piece as well, as we've seen that women around the world have been dropping out of the workforce in this pandemic at a much higher rate than men. It also has a socioeconomic thread to pull on. Parents who can work from home may be able to juggle children who are home differently from families where the adults need to work outside their home and can hire a nanny or a tutor. The socioeconomic piece comes into play in student outcomes as well, and we may not see the full extent of student losses for many more months, but it looks likely that poorer students will, on average, fall behind more than their more affluent peers. And, of course, so much is also dictated by the virus and by factors outside the control of a school or a town or sometimes even a state. So how do we pull apart these threads and then rearrange them to figure out what good policy might be that can have the most positive impact with the least amount of negative impact? Who even does that kind of work to look at all of this stuff and make some organized sense out of it? Well, Anne Sossen, for one. Sossen is the Global Health Initiative Program Director at Dartmouth College. Her research for the last 10 months has been focused on COVID-19 and rural health equity in northern New England. And her much-read Twitter threads start to tug on these kinds of issues in a comprehensive and yet understandable way. So today we invited Anne Sossen to join us to spend the hour talking through these kinds of thorny issues. Anne, what a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Jane.
Can you just explain, before we get into some of these issues, what it means to study rural health equity?
Sure. So when we're thinking about equity and health equity, we're thinking about much more than the prevalence of disease or biomedical treatments to it. We're thinking about a range of things that influence health and poor health outcomes. We're thinking about housing, food, we're thinking about the communities that we live in, discrimination, the natural environment, and all the ways that these factors come together to produce the state of our health. And so when we think about issues of equity, we see that some people and some groups are disproportionately and negatively impacted by these factors.
When we think about that word equity and, you know, its related word fairness, it can sometimes be open to interpretation what equity is or what fairness is. And depending on your own perspective and where you're coming from an issue, you know, where you're actually your lived experience is and where your head is can help determine whether you think something is fair or equitable. So how do you then define what equity is in order to be able to make some sense out of it or to say this might be a good idea or a good policy and this might not be?
So when I think about equity in the context of COVID-19 in particular, I think about vulnerability and the factors that shape vulnerability to the coronavirus, as well as to the secondary impacts to health and well-being. And I think about that both in the context of healthcare, as well as in those broader factors that shape our health.
We could start to look at that a little bit, and then we'll come back to it later when we think about something like vaccine policy. And in the state of Vermont, the stated priority of the state government and the health department is to prevent death. And so they are therefore prioritizing people based on age, followed by health status, with some certain conditions included in prioritization for vaccination that seem to have significantly negative outcomes for people who get COVID-19. That's a different kind of tactic than prioritizing based on exposure risk to the virus. And either one of those could be seen as a way to try to introduce equity into vaccination and state policy.
Indeed. And, you know, many understand issues of medical vulnerability and, you know, the risk that some populations, including those that are older and have underlying illnesses, have, you know, for severe forms of COVID-19. Very few understand, though, the social factors that structure vulnerability. And when I'm thinking about, you know, equity in the context of COVID-19, I'm really thinking about three things. I'm thinking about, one, vulnerability to severe illness and death, but I'm also thinking about risk of infection as well as risk of transmitting to others, including medically vulnerable populations. You know, and there are different frameworks for approaching, you know, vaccination that take into consideration issues of equity. And we can kind of divide these into two basic approaches. One is a direct approach, which seeks to target those that are most medically vulnerable to COVID-19. And that's the approach that we're seeing in Vermont. And we're also seeing that in many other states. But the approach that the National Academies of Science and Medicine, as well as the American Committee for Immunization Practices adopted, attempted to address the social factors that structure vulnerability to infection. So they take a more indirect approach to those particular factors. And there's interesting questions that come out as well around the unintended consequences of those approaches.
You know, it's interesting, too, because in some states, it seems like state policy is to try to do both at once, to try to protect medically vulnerable people by age and by health status, while also trying to address that sort of social vulnerability from people based on perhaps the jobs that they have or their living conditions. And, you know, while doing all of it at once, if you could, sounds like a great idea. It can also then kind of not do either, right? I mean, we're seeing shortages in some parts of New York State of vaccine supplies, and some people sort of getting in line ahead of other people because they're all eligible to get the vaccine. That is a very different approach than what the state of Vermont is taking.
It is a very different approach. You know, and states are trying to decide how much they should target transmission versus how much they should try to target severe illness and death. One of the unintended consequences, though, of the age-based approach is that it effectively deprioritizes some of the populations that are most socially vulnerable, including communities of color. You know, one of the thinking that went into the framework that was developed by the National Academies was that people are not at risk of infection for biological reasons. They're at risk for structural reasons, and those reasons include housing status as well as occupational status. And so the framework that were developed looked at structural vulnerability and attempted to target populations on that basis. And that's why we see the prioritization of the essential workforce in those frameworks that came out. And so as the country has shifted more towards an age-based approach, there is a risk of leaving populations that are at high risk of infection and of, you know, transmitting to other medically vulnerable populations behind. You know, and prioritization is only part of the picture in terms of achieving equity. Achieving equity requires attention both to prioritization and to the delivery systems to reach people, but it's an important component of it.
And, you know, I remember back to the very beginning of the pandemic and how it began in the United States and where the hotspots were here once we started seeing it in this country. And it seemed like at the time there were some big generalizations being made about whether rural areas were less susceptible to COVID-19 outbreaks than urban areas because of population density primarily. And then the idea that rural areas were necessarily at an advantage wasn't really borne out by the data as the pandemic progressed. Some of those outbreaks, even early on in rural states, happened in places like meatpacking plants or senior living facilities like we saw here in Vermont. So what have you learned about the benefits and challenges for rural states like Vermont when it comes to addressing COVID-19?
Yes. So there's a dual narrative, I think, that rurality confers protection and that rural institutions are fragile. And I think it's really the reverse that has been borne out by the experience of COVID-19. We see that rural regions have distinct risk factors, many of which are common with urban areas, but are really underappreciated. We see, you know, the presence of a range of congregate living facilities, including the long-term care facilities that have seen such devastating outbreaks. We see factories and prisons and other settings. We see that there's very high workforce mobility. So even though people are living spread apart from one another, they're moving quite a bit and have a high number of contacts. And that's really what structures risk. It's how many, you know, how many contacts you have, not, you know, where you're located. We also see, you know, quite a bit of housing insecurity and crowding. And that's another thing that structures risk to COVID-19. You know, and I think now as we see, you know, the devastation in rural parts of, you know, America, we are starting to understand that, you know, rurality is not protective. But early on, you know, many thought that we were just naturally physically distanced and had just missed the pandemic in this, you know, in this part of the region. That said, we see really strong rural protective factors emerging. The close social networks, institutional networks have enabled a very robust response across rural Vermont. And we've also observed that in our work in rural New Hampshire as well.
Can you give me an example of that? Like, what kinds of networks are you talking about that are doing good work in helping either protect people or sort of keep them afloat?
Yeah, so in many of the very rural parts of the state, there are networks that bring together the health systems, public health entities, community organizations, and other groups. And some of these groups were engaged in other work prior to the pandemic and rapidly mobilized, and others formed in response to the pandemic. And so we saw them mobilizing to increase critical care capacity at the small critical access hospitals. They were also engaged in the public health response and in meeting the needs of vulnerable populations across their communities. I think about the response in the Northeast Kingdom of the state, which has been one of the most effective across the bi-state region. And it was the presence of those strong networks that were in place that really allowed that region of the state to respond very swiftly to the threat of the pandemic.
Do you think that's specific to rural areas of the country or to rural northern New England, or is that just in contrast to what are sometimes seen as fragile community ties?
You know, I can't characterize the response in other parts of the country, but we see that the institutions here are deeply embedded in their communities. They're known institutions. They're really responsive to the communities of which they're part of. And I think, you know, and that's, you know, and I don't know that that's, you know, different from what we would see in rural Nebraska or, you know, South Dakota, but it is something that emerges as a real strength in the bi-state region where, you know, we've been doing our research.
Do you think it's different from what you would see in New York City or the center of, you know, Austin or something?
You know, I think that there are distinct strengths in our response. That said, you know, we know that many neighborhoods of New York have community organizations that play a critical role, in the life of those communities, and if mobilized, you know, can be really effective at mounting a response. You know, in our work, we talk sometimes about what we see as a rural ethos, or this constellation of pragmatism, compassion, and solidarity that we see manifest across our region. But, you know, that's underlined by, you know, strong community infrastructure. So it's not simply just, you know, a mindset, but rather something that manifests as really effective action, you know, at community and regional level.
You have seen some differences between the twin states, New Hampshire and Vermont, as well. And, you know, maybe that's a more apt comparison than, you know, trying to put Vermont up against, say, South Dakota. So what have you found in terms of what has worked well in either of the twin states in how the states are addressing sort of public policy around COVID-19?
So early in the pandemic, we saw that both states put in place really robust public health measures very early on. And it was those strong measures coupled with robust local and regional responses that contributed to the success that we saw across both states. But then we saw a divergence in early fall as, you know, cases started to increase on the New Hampshire side and on the Vermont side as well. And what we saw is that while community responses continued to be very effective on both sides of the state line, they were backed up by really strong state-led responses in Vermont in a way that they no longer were in New Hampshire. And so the changing epidemiology to some extent reflects, you know, the differences that the leadership and, you know, in both states the different approaches of statewide leadership.
Hmm. How important do you think it is when it comes to putting strict measures in place to prevent the spread of the virus? So strict lockdown measures, whether it's closing schools like we did in the spring, or not allowing multi-household gatherings, or really restricting what businesses can do and their capacity levels, and therefore how many staff members they can keep on, for example. How important is it to have economic supports in place that go hand in hand with those strict lockdown measures? And has Vermont done well with that?
That's a great question. I think Vermont has done exceptionally well as I look at other states. I think that Vermont's restrictions have been not only coherent, but really responsive to the changing epidemiology that the state has seen. And it's really important that the restrictions really follow the epidemiology and that they're targeting what we call the key drivers of transmission. But it's also been really important that the state has paired those public health restrictions with policy measures to offset their impacts. We often talk just about locking things down or closing things, but not about how is it that we can mitigate the economic and social impacts of those things. So that's one piece of it. And I think the other piece is that it has done, you know, a really incredible job of protecting vulnerable populations that are unable to adhere to the restrictions in place.
Like what? Like
So one of the things that Vermont has done exceptionally well is that it is around housing. Vermont's approach or use of housing policy as a primary tool of pandemic control is really emerging as a model for the country. And what do I mean by that? Vermont has enacted one of the country's most comprehensive eviction moratoriums. It's also had rental relief support for landlords. It has expanded its existing motel voucher program for its homeless population, and also has put in place a moratorium on utility shutoffs. And these housing protections are incredibly important given the role that housing plays in structuring vulnerability to COVID-19. We know that housing, along with occupational status, is one of the two key risk factors for exposure to COVID-19.
I also, you know, I think in this part of the conversation, I think about, too, the federal government's response and sort of added or beefed up federal unemployment benefits, and then the vulnerability that left people with when those were going away. And then the state's determination of how to spend federal dollars to assist businesses and different sectors of the economy, but also things that aren't necessarily about a person's job, but certainly then affect people's jobs, like how Vermont basically set up childcare grants in the spring and summer to try to keep childcare organizations afloat with all of the new expenses and the ability for Vermont's early childhood education centers to stay open in a way that they might not otherwise have been able to even during the lockdown. And similarly, the setting up of childcare hubs in the fall for students who were either doing remote or hybrid learning or whose parents needed to be in a place in the workforce. Do you think that has had an impact on our job? I mean, we're just looking at unemployment numbers today, and Vermont's rate officially is 3.1%, which is a tick up from last month, but still very low compared to the national average. And also, we should say, not reflective of the actual unemployment situation, but nonetheless, in comparison to the rest of the country, quite a bit lower.
I think that these have been incredibly important components of the response. You know, we've been studying the bi-state region, and one of the things that we heard early on is that many healthcare institutions were losing staff because they didn't have childcare coverage. That was the case in New Hampshire, but because Vermont put in place those supports very early on, it enabled, you know, healthcare institutions to function at a time when they were anticipating, you know, a surge of COVID-19 cases. But I also think that it's stabilized, you know, the workforce and the economy over, you know, over that period of time.
Christina is calling in from Underhill. Hi, Christina. How do you enter this conversation? You there, Christina?
Can you hear me?
Oh, I hear you now. Yeah, go right ahead. Oh, now I don't hear you. I think your line may be bad. So hang up and call back and we'll try to take you again. But, you know, Christina, I think was going to bring us into this sort of school area. And as we think about schools and the way Vermont has prioritized education and how that's working and not working for families, for students, for teachers and staff. Before we get into some of the details, can you just give us an overview of how you see this relating to equity, school policy, COVID-19, and equity?
Yeah, I think schools have played a critical role in Vermont's response. Very few states have had the approach that Vermont has had to education. And what I mean by this is that most states have really seen COVID-19 and their responses as centered around transmission of the virus and have sought, you know, to curb transmission to a level the health system can accommodate. And what's been really unusual in the Vermont response is that it's targeted its response to a large extent around the goal of opening and keeping schools open. Its restrictions, you know, have had that as, you know, as the, that as a goal. And so, you know, as the state has opened schools, schools have emerged as really critical actors in the public health response. They have helped to implement state guidance. They've served as critical public health public health messengers within their own communities. And they've also carried out other other community actions. And so as a part of our research, we've had a chance to speak with school leaders across the state to understand the roles that they're playing and what they're seeing and hearing in their communities, as well as some of the challenges that they're experiencing.
And, you know, so an example of that, you think back to some of the governor's press conferences where he will say, if we do this and that, if we can get the numbers low, if we can keep numbers low, we can safely reopen schools. It's, you know, it seems to be a message as well as a policy, but a messaging that says to Vermonters, this is why we have these restrictive policies in place. This is why we want you to sacrifice because we want schools to reopen. Do you think that's effective?
I think that that approach has been incredibly effective. And, you know, as you know, the Biden and his administration starts to think about how it can open schools across the country, I think it's, you know, a key lesson that emerges from the state of Vermont, that schools, you know, represent a policy choice and that states have to, you know, have to align their public health responses in line with that as a policy choice. And to contrast that with other states, many states have really just looked at the evidence around risks of, you know, transmission within a school setting and the harms of closing schools and haven't really thought of this as something that they're, that requires state action to make happen. So I think that's one of the key strengths that I see, you know, in the state's response around schools.
What do you think the state was clear enough? Now, I'm not necessarily just asking for your opinion here, although it certainly sounds like it. But, you know, as we think back to August, when the state education agency was making guidelines and policies for schools, and there were guidelines and some of them were pretty strict that schools would have to adhere to, but it really left it open to school districts to decide whether and how to structure their learning for in-person, remote, or hybrid. And so the effect was that different towns had very different policies. Different schools had very different policies. And on the one hand, you could argue, you know, towns and school districts know their community, they know their schools, and they know their needs. On the other hand, you know, you could be a family living in one town and have your students, your kids, fully remote, while one town over, the kids were fully in person. Not to mention the fact that some staff in these schools might live in a town where their children, their own children, were fully remote, but they were teaching students fully in person or vice versa. So, you know, that sort of state policy of allowing for local control seems to be in conflict with what then came from the state, this frequent push to tell schools, we want you to be open in person, even though we gave you the option not to be.
Yeah, so I I'm not an education expert, but my conversations with school leaders would suggest that there have been a lot of challenges around the implementation, this guidance at local level. Schools need a lot of support, both in terms of public health guidance to be able to do this, as well as in resources to undertake the changes needed to operate safely. And I know that there have been concerns that have emerged across the state around the supports that have been available for schools, and then the differences in how schools are able to do that based on the resources they have within their communities.
Let's go back to Christina in Underhill. Hi, Christina. Do we have a stronger line for you now?
Hi. Yes, I'm on my landline.
Oh, you sound great. Go right ahead.
Well, I mean, that's exactly the point I was hoping to make or ask about, is the disconnect between the governor's and the state's desire to get the schools fully open and all the kids back, and yet the vaccination being age-based. So I'm just wondering what's the thought behind not prioritizing teachers and staff?
Christina, let me ask you, when you think about it, how do you sort of tease it out in your own head in terms of what the state policy should be? And if it's actually in conflict or not, how do you think about it?
Well, I think about it as having three kids in the school system and my 80-year-old mother living next door. She would gladly pass up her vaccine to give it to a teacher at this point because she sees kind of what the kids are struggling with. And I just think if the community spread can be controlled by more people and more sectors of the population being vaccinated, that in the end protects all the vulnerable. So I understand wanting to prioritize, reducing numbers of deaths, but at the same time, I think that can also be achieved by getting more breadth of vaccinations out there.
Yeah, Christina, thank you. I really appreciate that, going deeper into, where you're coming from and how you see it, and bringing your mother into it, and this idea that we were talking about earlier with medical risk and medical vulnerability versus social vulnerability or exposure risk, and that those two things, are not always easy to figure out how to do the best thing for a population. And then you bring in this school priority, and boy, it gets complicated. Ann Sossen, what do you think?
Yeah, this is where it gets complicated, is, we're trying to think about how do we advance, two goals at once, with a very scarce resource and the vaccine. We're, interested in health equity and ensuring, that we optimize protection for, medically vulnerable populations, but we're also interested in, ensuring educational equity. There are a lot of considerations around the vaccine, and, I've thought a lot about what does this mean for schools in Vermont, and I know that you've seen a little bit of what I've written on this particular mm-hmm. topic. I think, I think from a policy perspective, it makes a lot of sense for a state to align all of its, public health resources with the goal of opening schools as fully as possible to in-person instruction. And I think then the question is, does this make sense from, a public health perspective? And as I look at the data that's coming out of schools, the introduction of cases as well as transmission within settings, the data would suggest that Vermont has done a really good job of mitigating transmission within schools, and that the risk in schools tends to be lower than the risk in some other occupational settings. And so, it may not make sense for the state to prioritize the entire educational workforce at this point in time, given how scarce the vaccine product is, but it's something that, the state might come back to later on. But really what we're trying to think about is, how do we use this very limited supply right now to protect the population in the best way, in the best way possible?
Yeah, you know, when Christina says my mom is in that older age range, but she doesn't have a lot of exposure risk, you know, she would take a back seat to let somebody with a greater exposure risk or, you know, in this case, teachers who are in line with the state's priority of opening in person get that vaccine sooner. You know, should that be a consideration?
You know, I think that we should think about how do we protect those that are most socially vulnerable as part of vaccination. You know, as we look at the data coming out of Vermont, we see that only 72% of deaths have happened in congregate settings, and those settings are getting vaccinated as a first priority. And so we see that while it's older populations that have, primarily had the greatest mortality, that we should see a pretty rapid reduction in mortality in the older age groups, given the prioritization of congregate settings as part of that first phase. And so the question, I think, becomes then how do we best control the pandemic with the vaccine product that we have? And, you know, and there is some reason to think that targeting transmission or those who are most at risk of infection, you know, would be an effective approach. That's not the approach that the state has, you know, elected to take, and their, you know, reasons for that. But it's something that everyone's grappling with.
What about also thinking about not just the risk of death, but, you know, we know now that a significant number of people appear to have longer term symptoms than just the course of the virus in their bodies. Often they're called long haulers. And we don't know much about it yet because the pandemic is so new, but this could have long term effects for some people. We also know that getting the virus could have a severe impact on your job, depending on your job security, you know, depending on what your life situation is. Even if you have a short course of the virus and come back healthy, your life might be significantly changed. So how do we factor that in, socioeconomic and cultural factors, into our policy around viral transmission and vaccination?
You know, exactly. And, you know, one of the things that strategies that are designed to target or reduce, you know, mortality only don't account for is morbidity or, you know, illness. And we know that there's a large population, people who've had COVID-19 who now have, well, you know, what we're calling long COVID, so chronic illness as a result of that. And, you know, vaccination that's only focused on reducing mortality at this point in time is not, is going to result in ongoing transmission among younger populations that are likely to have, chronic illness as a result of that.
Before we totally leave the topic of schools, Anne, we got a note from Ruth in Shoreham who says, in the name of equity, school boards across the state are moving toward closing town schools. I believe this actually moves us away from equity. These, quote, protective factors Anne Sossin just referenced will be further broken down. We all need more community, connectedness, and engagement, not less. Now, Anne, I know you haven't studied in depth, at least right now, this question of rural schools and small schools and sort of the value of small schools versus the sometimes the lack of opportunity. But, you know, this is something I think communities are going to be wrestling with in a new and different way because of the pandemic, because of what we've seen come out of small communities, how communities have adjusted to dealing with COVID-19, and that question of community cohesion. So do you see that this sort of one of the things coming out of the pandemic might be a difference in how we look at our community schools?
So I want to be careful about commenting on educational policy, but I think that the pandemic has really highlighted the importance of, you know, small community institutions. We've seen the effectiveness of small healthcare institutions and of other groups at community level, you know, in mobilizing a response. And I think schools have been a very important part of that equation. And so, you know, while I know that the considerations go far beyond, how schools respond to COVID-19, I think that we need to be mindful of what's lost when we start to, you know, we move away from community-centered institutions in any sector.
Let's talk a little bit as well here about ethnicity, racial identity, and how that plays a factor in COVID-19 and how state policy and state messaging is trying to address a disparity in COVID-19 rates. We know that Vermonters of color, like in the rest of the country, are susceptible to COVID-19, are contracting the virus at significantly higher rates. And what state public health officials have said about communities of color in terms of uptake of the vaccine is that historically, and for very legitimate reasons in many cases, certain communities are less likely to trust public health officials and maybe less likely to take a vaccine. So how are you seeing the state of Vermont addressing those issues?
So I guess I'd want to back up just a little bit and say that it's not biological factors
right.
that make communities of color more vulnerable to COVID-19. There's structural factors. So we need to talk about structural racism and not race, you know, and the ways in which that shapes vulnerability and the really extraordinary disparities that we see in infection rates and death. Here in Vermont, we see that Black Vermonters have infection rates that are more than six times higher than white Vermonters. You know, those are enormous disparities that can't go unnoticed, and need to come into the conversation around, you know, vaccine prioritization and delivery. So these are really, you know, important issues right now. Issues of hesitancy are really delivery issues, and those are barriers to getting, you know, vaccines into those communities, just like challenges around translation and access. But they don't speak really to the fundamental issues related to, you know, why communities of color are more vulnerable, to COVID-19, and or what's really driving those enormous disparities that we see not only in our state, but across the U.S.
And do you see state policy addressing those systemic issues?
You know, the national guidelines that came out attempted, you know, to prioritize structural racism over race for these very reasons. And there's been a shift away from the, that guidance, not only in the state of Vermont, but in many other states, out of a desire, I think, for, you know, expediency or simplicity. And so the question then becomes, well, if we are not going to prioritize people on the basis of, you know, structural risk factors, then, you know, what else do we have in place to do that? And so I'm not sure, you know, what the state's approach will be, but it's really important to think about prioritization as the first step in achieving equity and vaccination. I think the state, you know, has been really effective and thinking about how to deliver resources into communities on the basis of equity. And many of the strategies that it's employed around testing, around support to communities that have seen, outbreaks, will be really important to harness as it in the process of delivery. But that's really a very separate question or separate set of questions there.
Earlier in the summertime and in the fall, before any COVID-19 vaccines had been approved, it sounded to me like state health officials were frequently saying, we plan to prioritize communities of color when it comes to vaccine distribution. Now that we're actually into the state's mass distribution plan, that prioritization doesn't seem to be related to physical distribution of the vaccine or allowing certain people to be prioritized in when they can get the vaccine. Instead, now the state is talking about messaging around new Americans and Vermonters of color. And it also says it may put vaccine clinics in very specific areas to allow easier access to Vermonters based on where they live. Does that seem like a disconnect between what the state had been saying and what state policy is turning out to be with the vaccine, or does it not appear that way to you?
You know, I would, you know, I think that those are effective, you know, approaches to, you know, addressing some of the barriers around delivery, but I don't think that that's sufficient to address concerns around prioritization.
Let's talk about other messaging. We heard a message from Vermont Governor Phil Scott in a recent press conference in response to, I think it was a VPR reporter, John Dillon, asking, are you going to get the vaccine now? This was after Governor Scott had been exposed to the virus and was quarantining. And Governor Scott said, if I had my druthers, I'm paraphrasing, if I had my druthers, I would wait until all Vermonters are vaccinated before I get my dose. I definitely won't be stepping ahead in line. I'll be waiting my turn. But if I could, I'd let every single Vermonter go in front of me. I think I saw you on Twitter suggesting that that's not necessarily a good message for a state leader to convey to the public. Why not?
You know, I'd love to see our state leadership get vaccinated. I think it protects them. But even absent data on whether the vaccines protect against transmission, our state leaders are out in public, and you know they are with others, and so that protects other people. That will likely protect other people. I also think that it sends a great message to see state leaders, accepting the vaccine. So, I hope that our state leaders will, decide to get vaccinated. I also see that vaccination is critical for ensuring, the continuity of government operations. You know, last week we were watching the press conference by Zoom, and, that clearly was disruptive to their work.
Yes, and to the work of reporters who couldn't ask a question in person at that Zoom meeting. In December, in a tweet thread comparing New Hampshire and Vermont, you wrote about Vermont officials and the messaging throughout the pandemic as it relates to people and individual actions, and how Vermont officials were expressing a sense of optimism even when cases were rising. And you said, quote, Vermont's messaging has consistently communicated a dual sense of hope and agency. Communities hear that their actions matter, that it's possible to shape the trajectory of the pandemic, and that their actions will lead to meaningful benefits. Why do you think that has an impact, that type of messaging, even when you're getting specific factual data across?
I think it's important for two reasons. One is that it shows that the state is willing to take action in order to control the pandemic. You know, some states have described the course of the pandemic or a resurgence of cases as inevitable, and that, and that really deflects responsibility away from them. The second reason is that, states institute public health restrictions, but it's really incumbent upon communities to adhere to them. And when communities hear that their actions are shaping the trajectory of the pandemic, that they matter, they're much more likely, I think, to make the sacrifices necessary to, achieve the goals that have been set out by state leaders. One of the other things that I would add to that is that I think it's been really important that the state has set goals for the response that are locally meaningful. Most people don't really care so much about transmission, within their communities. It's hard to see long-term care facilities, but when you tell a community, that their collective actions can keep schools open, I think that becomes, very meaningful and much more proximate, to their daily lives.
How do you think about all of these things we've discussed today and all of the different threads, all of the different data points, and try to help people understand how to then move forward with state policy and with messaging? Like, how do we know things are working if it was because of policy or because of messaging or because of geography or because of luck or a relatively high socioeconomic status? I mean, how do you tease apart all of these threads to figure out the best next step and then the best step for the next pandemic?
Well, that's the focus of our ongoing research, thinking about what are the critical lessons, and how do we build? Really, the question for me is, how do we, build on what we've learned from this to advance, the goal of, creating a more equitable state? What is it we want to, we obviously want to get out of, the pandemic, but what is it that we can take forward from this, as we move forward?
Yeah. So I mean, what do you even use to try to determine that?
I think we pull on a lot of different data sources, but then we also look at what do Vermonters hope for as they look ahead, and what are the policies that we need to put in place to make that happen.
Well, I look forward to more research on that because, you know, I think it is going to be important to us as we move forward, not just in how we address COVID-19, but how we address all kinds of disparities and equity issues and things like school and education policy moving forward that could be informed by how the state responded to this crisis. So it's going to be really interesting to see your research coming out of this. And thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciated your insight.
Thank you so much, Jane.